Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
And nobody else, just Brian Brushwood. That's all you need. There never was anyone else. It's always been the Brian and Andrew show and our producer Bryce. Isn't that right, Bryce?
That is right.
Yeah, no, it's always been three guys.
That's a weird sequitur there, Brian. Why would you even mention the idea that there would have been?
I mean, sometimes people think that there was somebody else besides you and me and Bryce, but there wasn't. It's always been the three of us.
You know, Brian, great things come in twos. Like right now in our space with an able producer watching in between.
Yes.
Right now we have in the space race, we have SpaceX, which we just briefly covered. They had a launch, great launch, landing. They landed it. The rocket was really enthusiastic to get back down into the drone ship and accordion the engines, but overall, you know, one of those was a high altitude, one of these missions of like, you know, they said we're only gonna be able to collect so many, get so many of these back safely, so whatever. So it's within what their expectations are.
Is this old news or is this something that just happened?
Like 3 days ago.
Oh, I didn't know that they lost SpaceX lost one. What a bummer.
Well, I mean, yeah, but it's not they're like, meh, you know. They're already running out of space for the ones they have landed. This was one of those where they had to send it minimal fuel reserves, and it was just one of those maybe it'll make it, maybe it won't kind of thing. So it was a learning exercise. But today, Blue Origin did a launch. They had a successful launch of their new Shepard vehicle, and they actually sent up into, again, they're not doing orbital. Velocities are very, very different. When you think about space, it's not so much how high you go, it's how fast you go.
So basically, if anybody's paying somebody to put something in space, they're almost certainly paying for it to reach orbit so that it can be a satellite that yields either research or some kind of telecommunications or spy satellite capability.
Well, they do Blue Origin does do payloads for their suborbital, and like, because they have a couple minutes of free fall, so they are doing payloads and experimental payloads, but it's only for a couple minutes. But they tested out, they reused the rocket like I think for third or fourth time, and they put on board a human capsule, a capsule that no people are inside, but they wanted to like do a crash testing to see if this thing would be able, how it would, you know, handle an impact.
I'm so glad to hear you say this, because it was not clear to me whether or not this was the first time they had a capsule or not, because we've seen this rocket go up and then single stage land back down. But you're saying this is the first time that the capsule's gone separately that we've been able to watch?
They've done payloads before, but I think this is the first human. I made my mistake in conflating it with. I know they plan to do an intentional capsule crash too, but they did a little relaunch of this. So absolutely, congratulations to Blue Origin on your amazing reusable suborbital rocket system that is going to probably scale up in some ways to be able to do orbital and with their own solutions and stuff. I mean, it's a great time to be in space. Great time to be in space.
Did you watch it live this time?
No, I was sound asleep.
It was way early, and of course I'm a couple hours ahead of you on Central Time. But it's like I got up and I saw the Twitter chatter, and I was like, "Oh man, I'll tune in for this." And I tuned in about 1 minute after it had taken off. And hot dog, man, the entire presentation was super slick. It was awesome watching it go up. I was super curious because they very overtly stated this is the fourth trip out for this rocket, which you could take to mean this is the fourth trip for this design of the rocket or this exact reused rocket. I didn't poke around enough to know which one of those was true, but it was electric because everything went exactly according to plan. The separation was according to plan. First stage landing on its own was according to plan. The capsule stage landed, including firing the retro rockets to soften the blow, because as it was descending at the end, it was going 20 miles per hour at the very end just before impact. And they made sure to even say, hey, you're going to see a giant dust cloud kick up when this lands. That's not from impact. That is from the retro rockets firing that causes this.
It's awesome. I mean, and it's and it's neat to see that they've upped their game as far as the production of when they're showing what they're doing. it's a wonderful time to be in a space. Wonderful, wonderful time to be in a space. You know, but you know what, Brian? I'm bored with space.
Oh, really? You're ready to move on to what, hyperspace?
I think it's been established. I think we know what's going on there. Brian, I want to take you under the sea.
How deeply under the sea?
Brian, would you like to go, I don't know, 100 feet underwater?
I mean, 100 feet, it seems like if I had to leave, I would be able to... because, you know, this is how scuba divers kill themselves. From 100 feet down, they just hold their breath in panic, and then they go up and their lungs explode. But I'm going to guess at around 100 feet, I'd get the bends, but I could exhale slowly and make it to the top. Yes, 100 feet is perfect.
How about 105 feet?
Deeper than I'd like, but I'll go for that.
You know, I'm going to put you in a pressurized habitat. I'm going to put you in a pressurized habitat. Is that okay?
How safe is it?
Brian, safe is safe.
How big is it? Like, answer me this. Is it bigger than a nuclear submarine?
Maybe same sort of area. Maybe same sort of size.
I mean, doggone it. We definitely pay people entry wage, entry level wages to do that with the military. So sure, I guess I'll do that.
How about 200 feet?
That seems real deep. 200 feet, you're looking at serious bends issues. Did I ever tell you there's a friend of mine who's a magician here in Austin who used to weld at the bottom of oil rigs? So we're looking at 300 feet or so, and where you would spend like a week outgassing before you could come back.
You're in a pressurized container in this, so you don't have to. You it's like a sub. You come up, you walk out.
No. Yes on all that, but time out on this. He had a finger injury that messed up his middle finger. And when they're like, yeah, your knuckles exploded, basically. We have to set it permanently. And he said, will you set it at a slightly crooked angle so that I can palm a card with it forever? And so they permanently set his middle finger at the last part of the phalange is tilted down so he can still palm a card.
That's dedication. So yeah. We're in a pressurized environment, so you don't have to worry about bends. So 200 feet, is that cool?
Yeah. Theoretically, assuming safety, not a lot of room. What am I doing down there? Am I just playing Dungeons and Dragons?
Whatever your heart wants to do. So you okay? So you're okay with this? You know what? At your 200 feet, might as well go 300. You know?
I mean, you're right. At this point, I have the weight.
Your 300 might as well do 500. And you know what? If you're a 500, now you're looking at there's zero and there's 1,000. Which one do you want to go to? You want to go to 1,000? You want to go to 1,000, right? But you know what? If you're sitting around the table like, yeah, I was in a pressurized environment at 1,000 feet, people are like, oh, that's cool. And they're doing the math. And like, that's cool. But like, that's not even a quarter mile, you know? And then you're like, okay, how about I was a mile underwater? And now,
no.
Do you want to say you were like hanging out in a mile underwater?
Wait, for how long?
I don't know, a couple of days, a couple of weeks. Do you want to say that? You can bring your vibe. You can bring that.
Holy cow. Actually, this is a fantastic point because the moment you said bring the vibe, I was like, yeah, I won't feel like I'm trapped down there. I'll feel like, how good's the internet a mile down?
You know, when the surface ship is over, you know, you saw the abyss.
Yeah.
You know? So you're good on that. You know what? But Brian, a mile, you're like, oh, that's cool. Then people immediately convert it to feet and they're like, oh, that's like 5,200 feet. And you know what? You're like, let's just go for 10,000 feet.
Okay, now you're freaking me out. Like, is this beneath, like, lava or something insane?
You're in the ocean.
Well, I know, but it's like at 10,000 feet. That's Mariana Trench?
Mariana's Trench.
Yeah, Mariana's Trench.
I mean, level. You know, let me give you an example of when we're talking 10,000 feet. You have, like, when you want to talk about, like, Challenger depth, you know, which is like, which was the Challenger Explorer, how deep that went. That was like insane. So
that was the one that James Cameron did, right?
He did 36,000 feet.
Oh, that's so deep. That's so deep.
So okay. you're not even 30% of that. Okay. Not even 30% of some dilettante movie director decided to go to.
All right. You got me. Fine. Yes. I'll go to 10,000 feet and just hang out in a nuclear sub-sized environment for how long though? Am I trapped there forever?
No. I wouldn't do that to you. Well, Brian, you'll be happy to know that if you want to do this, all you have to do is apply for Chinese citizenship and have a lot of qualifications and hope this is one of those far-off ideas that they say they're going to do that actually happens. Chinese government has talked about, or China's talked about, they want to build an underwater space station 10,000 feet below the surface.
I got to admit, that's a pretty badass thing to do.
And China President Xi Jinping last month announced at National Science Conference that this was one of the things they wanted to do was for deep sea exploration. And, you know, you could have some potential, you know, military applications there, too. He didn't shrink away from. So they want to build a deep sea station at 10,000 feet, which if you watch the Abyss, Deep Star 6 or any of those other movies, you know, this does not turn out poorly.
Well, can we talk a bit about the fact that you and I grew up in an age where the Abyss was ubiquitous viewing? But I'd be curious, like, Bryce, you're what, 15, 20 years younger than me?
I am 26.
Yeah, okay, so 15 years younger than me. Did you ever watch the Abyss?
I didn't.
See? Yeah. That's my point. Like I'm just saying, like there's a lot of people who don't, like one of the things the Abyss did really, really well is give you a healthy fear of what it's like to be so deep and so isolated and so broken away from the rest of the world.
That and Sphere. And so many of you have not seen the Abyss. It's worth watching. That was, one of James Cameron's really big breakthrough special effects films. And he wanted to show basically do a kind of like what would be like a deep space film, but set in an underwater facility. And it's a remarkable, an incredible technical achievement. The story is kind of, you know, good and strong in some places. In other places, it's sort of like, okay. But it is, I think it's an enjoyable story. I think it's actually good. Technically, one level, a lot of it gets attention because that was one of the first big uses for digital computer graphics where they wanted to create these, spoiler alert, they come in contact with another species that's intelligent. And they have, like, they can control water. So they have these sort of, like, water beings that are made of water. So that was one of the first uses of computer graphics to create characters and animation at that level. But technically speaking, they shot this thing in a massive underwater pool, which I think was like
it was a former nuclear facility.
Cooling pool.
Right. And what they needed, and this was a fascinating technical achievement, is they needed to be able to totally black everything out so it looked like it was, 20 miles under sea or whatever. And so what they ended up doing is covering the entire surface of this giant nuclear cooling tank with little black plastic pellets that covered everything and let no sunlight through. So if they needed to, people could swim up to the surface. But one of the other thing is, and this is one of those things that you don't really think of, is in your mind, they do such a good job of presenting the communication facilities as if there's just radios between everyone. But you forget, these are actors, this isn't a real place, and there's not a monetary advantage to having any kind of communication between actors except for from the director to the actors. So they all only had one-way radios. It was only James Cameron would occasionally pop into their ears and say, like, yeah, do it again. This time I want you to swim a little faster or slower or whatever. And but the actors figured out, because that's another thing you have to do is in the context of telling a story, you have to be able to see their faces. They had these giant masks that they designed that allow you to see their faces. They figured out that if they got close to each other and pushed the faceplates next to each other, they could shout to each other and go, "What's going on?" And the other person can barely hear and say, like, "We have to do it again. So-and-so heard. He has to move faster."
It was an incredible and you watch this movie and you have to remember they're really underwater doing this. They're really running around in these pressure suits. They're really that, the person falling behind in a submarine really is doing that. The digital effects weren't to the point that now you would put a bunch of people in a blue screen thing. You would probably, if you wanted to, you'd probably do blue screen. You might digitally create the entire suit except for their face and change the motions or put them in, a single tank and capture what you needed to. What he did in the practical effects in this movie were absolutely insane for what they were able to go capture.
Yeah, that's to go on a kind of a side jag. That's one of the great points. If you've ever seen the Mr. Plinkett reviews for Titanic or for The Phantom Menace and so on, the Red Letter Media makes this review of Titanic where they explain how they make a 30-minute case for why it's the best movie of all time. Then they make a 30-minute case for why it's the worst movie of all time. But when they're talking about why it's the best movie of all time, they explain that it was at a technological sweet spot when there was things they just could not possibly do with computer graphics. So they actually got hundreds of actors that they just, you know, let, you know, tens of thousands of gallons of water blast over. And they had these awesomely realistic, you know, three-quarter scale models of things that they get washed and blast down. I'm sure all these numbers are wrong. But I think The Abyss was part of that same time period, mm-hmm. right? Where it made more sense to actually build a system for actors to jump all around.
Yeah, there's the video that Bryce is playing here. We'll put that into the show notes to watch the behind the scenes. It's absolutely incredible when you look at the size and scale of that. And you know, and you get just respect for the, I think James Cameron's the only director in the world that could pull this kind of thing off. You know, he's brilliant. He's a, you know, a scientist in his own right. He's technically inclined. The fact that this guy actually did go and do a deep sea mission himself, you know, set the record, you know, is no coincidence. I mean, this is a guy that's been deeply involved in this stuff.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, by the way, when your logical plan, this is so Elon Musk. He's like, well, I want to do a really good story about Titanic. Seems like I should go discover the Titanic and get a bunch of really good footage of the Titanic that nobody's done before. Hang on, give me a second. Let me invent a probe to do that. Oh, also, we need to see their faces. Let me hire this guy to develop a brand new breathing apparatus that shows people's faces. And we're done. Let's make The Abyss.
Yeah, there was talk that he wanted to go to the International Space Station to shoot stuff for a movie. That, you know, gave serious consideration to doing that. I met the guy who was his accountant. That was interesting.
Did he just have a 1,000-yard stare of having dealt with an insane man for 30 years?
Yes. He had his counter, like he was showing up once to get on one board one of the ships, and Cameron's like, "Who are you? Why are you on my boat?" It's like, I'm the accountant. I'm the guy that has to keep track of what we're. Oh.
Right. That is amazing.
Yeah. All the stories about him, they're all true. All of it. Brian, I'm going to tell you an amazing idea. But before we do that, we need to tell you, hey, if you like the show and you want to support the show, want to help it happen, please go to Patreon. That's patreon.com/ Weird Things. This is how we bring the show to you. It's done by your support to our patrons. Thank you so much. We really, really appreciate it. It makes it possible for us to do this. And if you think about support, throwing a couple shekels our way, it would be really, really good. You know, we can keep doing this, keep doing a little bit more, expanding on what we're doing. So please, please consider checking that out at patreon.com.
Hells yes. All right. What do you got?
Brian, I got an idea.
I knew it. I saw that twinkle in your eye, and I thought, good thing my daughters are not in the house. What's going on?
Your daughters would love this, Brian.
Yes, they all say that, but I need you to explain why.
So we've talked about before Monkey Island, right? You know, this was this wonderful visionary in Los Angeles back in the 1930s, brought in 1,000 monkeys, put them on this island surrounded by a moat, which is actually just a stone's throw from where Universal Studios is right now, with this vision that you could come there and see the monkeys as they frolicked around, did their monkey business, and the monkey shines and throw them food, and they'd wave back at you because they're in this monkey utopia, right?
Yeah.
And
well, then, I mean, mainly because they know that when they wave, they get free, you know, Mars bars thrown at them or whatever.
Like when we know and we do this podcast, people contribute on Patreon, Brian.
Yes, exactly. We're the monkeys. It turns out everything we've said about Monkey Island is an allegory for the three of us on Weird Things.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a beautiful idea. And, you know, part of what I love about America was that our country, there were so many of these utopian communities planned during the 19th century. So many different, you know, these people said, we want to have a better way of living, a better life. We think we've cracked the code and we're going to go start this town based around that. And these inevitably fell apart. And there's been some great books that talk about how many of these towns across the United States in the 1800s are actually these ideas for utopian visions, either religious communes, socialist communes, or some other sorts of ideas of how we'll figure this out, right? There was a tremendous amount of experimentation done on that.
Sure.
Now, Monkey Island here in, you know, as a tourist attraction could have been an idea of that. But the problem is it's an island. It's limited. You know, you're stuck on this little island here in LA, and it's not a lot of room. And the monkeys, there's a lot of monkey crowding, and the monkeys were like, hey, we're going to sneak out in the middle of the night. They swam across the moat and they escaped. We've talked about this.
Which, by the way, is pretty extraordinary because from what I understand, monkeys, they don't – I mean, they can swim. Everyone could swim, but they don't like to. They don't like to swim.
No, but, you know, they decided they're going to move out on their own. So we still don't know where they went. But,
sure.
Brian, this is what I'm getting to is I think that I have a better vision for this, okay?
All right.
Problem with Jurassic Park, stuck on an island. Those dinosaurs, they're cooped up in there. They're kind of angry with each other, and they start eating each other and the tourists, right? Jurassic World, great movie, but they're kind of stuck there. What they need is a little more room, a little more room to grow in. You know what I'm saying?
Are you talking about like a monkey Jeep Grand Cherokee or something that they drive around in?
I'm talking about like instead of putting them on an island, like a village, kind of like in a more open sort of area. What I'm saying is we take a town. Maybe a town once, you know, like a big thing now for towns, like maybe we'll you know, like a lot of states, like medical, we'll legalize marijuana because, you know, that'll increase our productivity. Instead of that.
First of all, that is 100% true if we're talking about the productivity of their macrame. Off the charts, yes. The moment that happens.
Yeah, yeah. So in casinos, like we'll do casinos. It's like there's either like, hey, let's build an education and tech center and become a tech giant, or let's, you know, gambling and pot, you know.
Wait, question, time out. And I want to get to where we're going, but you just introduced something. Do monkeys gamble? Like, from what I understand, and this comes from The Rational Optimist by Matt Ridley. He says that yes, there are the ability to form tools and they understand tokens, but monkeys will not willingly give up something for the possibility of getting something else. Like that is a uniquely human.
Monkeys do gamble in their own way.
How so?
They believe in winning streaks, losing streaks. They pick up false. Remember, part of gambling is based on the idea as the belief in winning and losing streaks, right?
Right.
The hot hand fallacy. Monkeys can have the same thing. If you give them an intermittent award and they start to think that they're winning more than should be, they'll keep they'll keep giving up. They'll keep like sacrificing to try to get more. And that's why gambling works, is it plugs into a very primitive level of our brain that's pattern seeking, and it tricks our pattern seeking system because it's, oh, I think if I do this, I get more and I get more. And then we have this rationalization level that comes in like, I didn't get it that time because I should have bet on the 7 instead of the 6. Now that I know that.
Right.
But Brian, wow. We don't need that. We don't need that. What we're going to do is what I propose is that we take a town, maybe somebody there has a town that they want to create a tourist attraction, and we bring in a bunch of monkeys, like a bunch of macaque monkeys, a bunch of them, okay?
I mean, I already love it. Why wouldn't I? I mean, I say next time there's a comic book convention, let's bring in a bunch of macaque monkeys.
I think it would be an amazing attraction because imagine you go to a town – like what's your town got? Oh, we got an antique row, you know. We've got – you know, there's going to be a Walmart outside of town. I know that. We got a Cracker Barrel. It's really nice. We got our own local coffee shop, which is pretty cool, and we got an ice cream plot. Yeah, it's good. There's a little gazebo, and we got stuff. Like, oh, we got monkeys.
What?
It would be awesome.
I mean, okay, it's a bit of a toss-up because I got to tell you, this is half true to an experience that I had when my parents were living in Venezuela. Like, I would say a third of all the restaurants that we went to just had giant three-foot iguanas, three-foot lizards hanging out outside. That was pretty badass. And I don't know which would be the bigger draw, monkeys or lizards. Because on the one hand, yes, monkeys are more adorable and they're more they have greater faculty with their fingers, but the lizards never once tried to steal my wallet.
Yeah, I had a problem in Puerto Rico trying to go to a Wendy's when there was a giant lizard sitting across the sidewalk that would not let me pass. It was – and like I understood everything you know about Chupacabra and all that. It was this big iguana. I mean, huge, sitting on the sidewalk. And I'm like, hey, I'm going to go to
– Turns out I'm going to stand right here.
I had to walk into traffic.
Take it easy.
Walk into Puerto Rican traffic to walk around this thing because you're like, oh, they're vegetarians. Yeah, so is Hitler. So
they're vegetarians.
Brian,
so is Hitler.
I mean, I had kind of stomach problems, but anyhow. villagers in Jiangfeng, China, I mean, China's the new Florida, by the way, which is located in Sichuan, China, had an idea. They wanted, about 10 years ago, they decided they wanted to boost their local economy, and they came up with the idea of using wild monkeys to attract tourists. Apparently, there's a Emi Mountain, which is another tourist attraction, worked out really well. I would love to have been at that city council meeting. I'd love to have been there. You know, where they're like, hey, we're going to have a meeting talking about what we can do to increase tourism. And then somebody stands up, raises their hand and says, I have an idea.
I'd like to think he's got a giant overstuffed. He looks like an obese man wearing a trench coat. And he goes, you want your new attraction? Here it is. And he whips open this trench coat and out pops, you know, six monkeys jumping around. And instead of everybody being horrified, they immediately delight as they all begin to dance in choreographed, synchronized fashion.
So what they did is they had an investor. They brought in, they said, you know what? This is a great idea. And they imported 73 of the apes, you know, the monkeys from nearby mountains. Apparently the plan took off right away. They had a wave of visitors. People were eager to come up, meet the monkeys, hang out. And so there were more interest, you know, more money was coming in to sort of increase, like build the park around it, whatever. And it was just a happy story, you know, and then sort of.
Well, okay, it's the and then dot, dot, dot that makes
Well, there's 600 monkeys there today now, Brian, and I would say as a monkey population, that is a huge success.
Yeah, sure, but it doesn't—
monkeys to 600 monkeys, your net return on monkeys is fantastic.
It doesn't sound like from an entrepreneurial angle this was a terribly great success, though.
Okay. So the park itself, that would be like the revenue generating thing, you know, was kind of ended up going bankrupt, and maybe the novelty of the monkeys worn off. But the fact the monkeys is a breeding population, that there are 600 of these monkeys now, I got to say that's a triumph of evolution. I would say that, you know, and Malcolm's right. Nature found a way. You know, use terms like overrun, terrorize, destroying crops and homes.
Okay, let's establish what those
fighting
means. Overrun means, if I was their PR agent, I would explain that the breeding population or the breeding program has been wildly successful beyond all our expectations. Fair enough.
Yeah.
And what was the next negative word you used?
Terrorizing.
We can verify this is the most exciting monkey-themed experience in all of China.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you're having authentic encounters.
Yeah, there's not a lot to dress that one up.
But I mean, like, you want to go to, like, you could go to other places and they're behind bars and they're behind there and you're just—
Got it. Yeah. TV. Unlike Western organizations, we allow our animals to run free because we care about nature and the environment.
Yeah. Destroying crops.
We've trained our populations to survive on local bounty.
Ooh, yeah. Locally grown and supported.
There you go. Locally grown bounty.
Farm to table.
Farm to table, to their table, straight from
God's
green earth to their mouth. Yeah.
Farm to monkey paw. So the villagers have now, it's become a problematic, and they're, so far they've tried to recapture the monkeys and to send them to live in the wild. So the problem is that the experts said the remaining half are determined to stay, and the villagers will have to learn to coexist with the apes until they leave on their own accord. Oh, jeez. I want to be at that meeting where the experts are like, hey, you guys did this to yourselves. These monkeys aren't going. And I mean, and this is a country where if you want to build, I don't know, a theme park for an industrial giant, you know, they will clear out an entire village overnight. But,
yeah,
you know,
it's also the perfect ending if this was an animated movie. Like it's like Chicken Run only with monkeys. Then at the end, the big wig politicians say, well, there's nothing we can do. I guess we all have to live together. Cue montage and plucky, jaunty theme as animals of all varieties start getting along.
How would you like to be a real estate agent in that area?
I mean, it sounds like I have quite a knack for it, if you ask me. Yeah. I'm going to quit this whole magic and internet gig.
Gosh, that would be a that, there's a TV show or something there, or a real estate agent or developer for places that have like these horrific has to solve these sorts of problems.
Either that, or at least it's got to be an element in like a Real Estate Tycoon, the game.
Yeah,
where that would be amazing.
I mean, who would a village over other than you and I? Who would a village overrun by monkeys be an upsell for?
I gotta think. Well, I mean, the problem is
medical
I assume,
research.
Well, I assume they're all disease ridden and so on, right?
So are you, Brian?
I mean, yes, I am. I'm not going to deny that. Yeah, I don't know.
I would say like I think I would just start like you know medical research facilities. Like, yeah, if you want to do your medical research there, it's fine. You need subjects. Just leave the back door open.
Do you think that's the kind of thing that you could actually get approval from the local municipalities where it's just like, hey, understand you got a lot of monkeys. I have a way to make way fewer monkeys. Also, some of those monkeys might be infected with a super virulent mutagen virus that could go anywhere.
I think there are ways we can investigate ways to spin it, but I would say that might be a possibility. You know, it's just if you medical research laboratory, like leave the back door open. You know, next morning, you got all the subjects you need. Sounds not that I advocate that at all, people. I think you should always test these things on humans, preferably children first, before you use animals.
Yeah, by the way, real quick public service announcement. I got some dog shampoo, and it was pretty messed up to find out that that stuff was tested on animals. I'm not cool with that.
Yeah, that's unfair. I got like some scalp shampoo, and it smelled exactly like the stuff they used to give my dog.
Like, I believe it.
Yeah, listen... There are many, many children today available for testing. They got nothing else to do. Might as well do that first. You know.
It's getting too close. I'm waiting for you to ask which of my children I would volunteer for that kind of stuff.
Which of your children would want to live in a monkey village?
All of them. Oh, my yeah. God. Yeah. Are you kidding me? Yeah.
Up until Brian, do you want to do picks?
Yeah, man. I've got a few different picks. There was one I was going to hold off. Hold on. Let me open up my Audible queue here because I just finished something.
I'll do my pick.
Yeah, you know what? Here, I don't think we talked about this. Bryce, did I mention that I finally got around to reading Larry Niven's Ring World?
No, I don't think you have.
Yeah. Have you read it?
Oh, yeah. I met Larry, too.
See? Okay. All right. Cool. Well, then I really, really like the visuals, the ideas and stuff. It is certainly one of the most important science fiction books.
Absolutely.
But pretty much anything written longer than 20 years ago, it seems like science fiction used to be so highly structured and would just sort of end abruptly. You know, and I felt that vibe from Ringworld. Like, were there other Ringworld novels afterwards?
Oh yeah, no. And they're still doing new ones.
Okay, so yeah, that's very much what I got the impression from is that, so in that regard, I guess I have to look at it in its place as being the beginning of a giant journey. But I would say I enjoyed the world, I enjoyed the place, I enjoyed the interaction between different aliens. Was not a fan of. It just seems like previous to 1980 or 1990, relationships in science fiction were very like, hey, we are in love. Yes, we're in love. Oh, but I am a free spirit. Now I leave. Okay, you are a free spirit. Now you leave. And so it's fine. I got a little bit of that, which I suppose you could take as evidence of a more egalitarian, nuanced set of relationships in the future. But it's always jarring to me in that regard.
Well, and that the science fiction authors seem to write a lot about the idea of being able to get in and out of relationships with commitment free.
Just like that. Just like
the contract, you know, the marriage contract is a big thing. I would say that some of that is very much a product of the times of the 60s and the 70s. Not to say that it might not be an idea, a notion that comes back again, because they were trying to explore the ideas of once you reached equality, and if once you reach a point where women aren't the possessions of men that you have a contract for, and then you can only sever under a certain conditions, et cetera, things become different. And certainly I think it speaks a lot to sort of the lifestyle and mentality of science fiction authors. Yeah. I just sent you a photo.
I didn't know if I was allowed to talk on this photo, but this is an extraordinary photo. If can I speculate what I'm looking at?
Yeah, sure.
I see two theater seats, one that says Jerry Pournelle, the other one that says Larry Niven. Dr. Jerry Pournelle, I had the privilege of sparring with on speculating about the future time before. But I'm assuming, since I've only seen you in a movie theater, Skype into Weird Things once, would this be at that place that you Skyped in before?
No. This was actually at the Writers of the Future award show.
Oh, that's very cool.
So they kindly let me get to sit in the front row with them. Not me, actually, because, you know, my guest got the front row. So it was with the Britt and Bree Winter, the Winter twins there. And so, but yeah, I've spoke to him briefly. I mean, he has no idea who I am, nor cares. But yeah, those are legends. They're still with us, Niven and Pournelle. And I just finished reading, a couple weeks ago, Footfall. The both of them wrote Niven and Pournelle. I would say that those things they get into, Footfall particularly, it's very much about the idea. Let's discuss this idea. And yes. Ringworld is this, what if you encounter this alien civilization that is utterly unlike anything that we've ever considered of before? And for those of you who don't know, the premise is that Ringworld was, Niven had this idea of a massive ring at one astronomical unit and going completely around a star.
Well, and one of the things I enjoyed in the book is he basically describes it as a half-assed Dyson sphere compromise, where it's mm-hmm. like in theory, a Dyson sphere would be a physical structure that completely encapsulated a star and collected 100% of its energy. But then they bring up in the idea of Ringworld, it's like, well, you're going to get too much energy. You're going to overheat. You're going to bake from the inside. You can't possibly, there's no way to dissipate it, because on Earth, we're able to, reflect a bunch of heat, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea was that given sufficiently advanced technology, you would have this ring that went all the way around a star so that it was able to collect all of the energy for a lot of the time. And you would need over that giant rectangular structures that would pass in a pass and create day night cycles. But mm-hmm. there would never be a sunset. It would just sort of be everything's bright, and then all of a sudden everything's dark, and then everything's bright again, and everything's dark. And they, speculated on what kind of wild weather patterns there would be, what kind of weird geological upheavals would occur should a asteroid hit different chunks of the ring world. Intellectually and it's a very, very visual world. The characters are fairly flat and
thin.
Right.
The later book, and again, it's about the idea. And later books get into the physics, because theoretically, just a ring around a star would be like trying to balance a plate on top of a ball. It's not. It would be unstable. And actually, that was Niven would be at a at a science fiction conference, and a bunch of MIT students were like, Ringworld's unstable. And so they incorporated later.
Did they actually chant that? Tell me that's a real thing that happened.
Real thing.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah. but I mean, and he's expanded. There's, like they said, that series continues to this day now with prequels and other books. And it gets weirder. The Ringworld, Ringworld Engineers, the other books there, they get into even weirder cultural sort of stuff. My pick, kind of sort of somewhat related, is I was watching imminently rewatchable Back to the Future, right?
Oh my God, does it ever hold up? To when we were kids, 1955 was an alien world. So to my kids in 2016, 1955 feels every bit as alien in a world, so it's like, it's to us, it was somebody going from modern day to alien land. To my kids, it's just someone going from alien land to a farther back alien land.
Yeah, I would say that his Marty McFly's 1985 isn't terribly, we've reached this point kind of like in the internet age where you can see somebody walking down the street dressed like anything, and there's enough appreciation for retro and some things like that it's sort of like the future, the present is whatever time period you want it to be in the last 20 years or so, in a sense, to some degree, except for Jesus Jones and certain musical things. But I'd say it was a much more much more jarring for us in 1985 to look back at 1955 than 2015 to look at 1985.
Right.
The exception of where's the internet or where's World Wide Web. But anyhow, in there. And also, like, too, you watch it again and you get a better – if you rewatch it and you're like, oh, let me pay attention to Marty's character development. You figure out what his character arc is. It's very clearly put in there despite what, you know, one of the creators of my favorite cartoon series ever said. But George McFly, there's a throwaway line in there. And George McFly runs home and he says, I got to get home in time to watch my favorite TV show, Science Fiction Theater. I had thought, oh, like, I guess that's like their copyright-free version of saying Twilight Zone or something like that.
Which or the Outer Limits or whatever.
It didn't exist for years later. There actually was a syndicated TV show called Science Fiction Theater. And Science Fiction Theater was an anthology show that predated all of those shows, right? And I found all of the episodes online. They did the first season was actually in color, right? And then they did the second season in black and white because nobody had color. They're like, nobody has color TVs yet, so we'll just do it cheaper in black and white. And they're 30-minute episodes that start off with this narrator talking about some scientific principle.
Right.
And talking about this, hypnotism, magnetism, or physics or whatever. And then it goes into the episode. And I would say the actual story time in the episodes themselves is maybe 18 minutes. They're almost like haikus or cones. They're very like – they're like one-act plays. There's just a couple sets. I watched three or four of them, and to be honest with you, really enjoyed them. Really, really been digging the ones. They're not super high-tech. The second one they did – this family lives next door to this house, and they're finding their TV and, you know, their electrical appliances are being interfered with, and they go talk to the next door neighbor, and the guy who lives there, you know, the person goes over to look next door. He peers through the window and he sees an effing Roomba, by the way. They call it electric broom, sweeping up the floor. This little disc-shaped robot going around the floor, sweeping out. It was a Roomba, and they realize that their next-door neighbors, they find out, are actually from the future, and they're hiding out in the past because the future's become too mechanized and run by computers and robots. And in order to get away from that, people from the future now go back and hide out in different time periods.
Man, I've been thinking about that phenomenon this whole week. I finally got around to reading the Wired article about the computer program that beat the world champion at Go. And it's is the idea of humanity being the pets of slightly more intelligent AIs terrifying? Does that make you want to go into the past and run away?
I just real quick, Bryce, when you put up the playlist, make sure it's the one that has the full 4:3. Somebody uploaded a bunch of them and they cropped them, and so you know to fit a 16:9 aspect ratio, and it looks like garbage. But there's 4:3 full, and the 4:3 ones are.
And these are all on YouTube. Is that right?
Yeah, all on YouTube. So, and there's a whole interesting history of the guy. Ivan Torres, who's one of the producers that went on to go produce Flipper and all this. He produced a lot of really pro-science content. He did another show about called, like, you know, Man on Challenge, and it was about a scientist going around testing the limits of human endurance and stuff. Yeah, so there's been a lot of cool – he did a lot of cool stuff. But to your question, you know, my fear when it comes to the AI and the robots is they're not a static thing. They're a thing that's constantly accelerating, and, you know, the future is not just a bigger version of the past.
Well, and that they iterate geometrically. That's one thing that we are all fundamentally broken as humans when it comes to is understanding geometric progression versus linear, right?
Yeah, and so that's – I'm a pro. Hey, let's explore AI. The initiative OpenAI, which is what, you know, Elon Musk and others have gotten behind, is like, let's understand this technology. Let's figure out how we can basically use it to our advantage, not find ourselves down a path where we create things. And part of the problem is we could create dumb machines that are far smarter than us, that have single purposes, that could really do tremendous amount of damage, you know. It's not a matter of it all of a sudden it starts twirling its mustache and says, I will take over the world. It's, oh, I can solve this problem by genetically engineering a virus that will wipe out, you know,
what
these
about
that are-
this? Think about this as a flashpoint of history. And forgive me if it's something that I'm almost certain as I describe it, you're going to tell me about a paper or someone.
Simpsons did it.
Yes, exactly. But what if it becomes a common refrain that every so often, let's say we have a massive intelligence or a series of intelligences that are all slightly sharper than human brains. And from time to time,
lasers are burning.
AIs come to Congress and say, hey, we have this idea. It's going to cut the energy, the cost of energy in half globally. We would like to implement it, but per our programming, we would never do anything without your permission. Here's an explanation. Here's the abstract. Here's why it works. Can you have your smartest scientist look at it and just make sure you're okay with it? And then they do, and they say yes, yes, yes. But then let's say in 2063, all of a sudden, for the first time, this old routine for the 20th year in a row, the AIs come and say, hey, we got this new thing. It's going to allow us to colonize beyond the stars. It's a new advance. We want to spend our resources to do it, but we will not do it unless you guys, you know, get all your scientists to understand it. And what if all the scientists get together and they're like, yeah, we don't understand what this is. So what is the moral obligation of humanity? Let's say Congress at that point, do they say, yes, go ahead and do it because we believe you when you say it will bring us all this abundance? Or do we say, no, we are morally obligated to not let ourselves become the puppies of our children?
I mean, that gets into, you know, that was one of the Nick Bostrom tried to get into in Superintelligence is, you know, the trust factor. How do you know when you trust it? How do you know, you know, when do you let it out of the box? And then when do you start, when they start coming up with like, yeah, no, I found a treatment that can increase your longevity or quality of life. And we look at it and there will be a point where part of the point of the singularity is that kind of there's a lot of misinformation and people have a lot of confusing ideas of what that means with the singularity. But the idea is that it's that point at which we can't really comprehend how rapidly or how differently things will be. And part of that means is machines giving us treatments for diseases that we cannot comprehend, that are too complex for us. Machines building other machines that are too sophisticated for us to understand how they work. And that's a scary thing for people to try to comprehend and try to figure out. Just real quick, in the chat section, somebody mentioned Chiller Theater. Chiller Theater was a host who would host shows, introduced old B movies and stuff. I've never talked about it on these microphones, but you know there was actually a new Chiller Theater.
Oh my gosh, are we about to hear a bomb drop?
There was a new Chiller Theater, and they tried to do a launch. Maybe about the 1990s.
Yeah, and did it maybe feature a super talented illusionist?
It's possible.
Oh my gosh! Perhaps that person went on to be a best-selling author.
I'm just saying that it was a very, very, very amateurish production. No
offense to the people. Oh, that's wonderful! Oh, can we have a party where we all get together and watch it? And oh, that's what we should do. We should all take some of our early works, you, me, and Justin, and have a party where we deconstruct our own stuff.
Yeah, I met a guy who actually got permission to do a new Chiller Theater. And then so I did a bunch of episodes of that, hosted like their Halloween specials and things like that. And it was fun. It was a fun thing to do live kind of thing. But it was the production was just, they shot it literally in a morgue, you know. It was aired on like different like, you know, syndicated or public access shows and stuff like that. I was actually considered by TBS at one point to host their late night movies.
This was wonderful. Yeah, no, there's in a similar vein, I feel like we should both confess. My friends, before they did Double Toasted, a bunch of my friends did Spill.com, and before that, they were, oh my gosh, there it is, the new Chiller Theater with Andrew Main. Oh my gosh, this is amazing. This is amazing. This is the best thing on the planet. But my friends, before they did Spill.com, look at you.
Look at that
hair. Oh, my God. Oh.
The posting date, it's a lot older than that.
Oh, this is wonderful. Before they did that, they did something called The Real Deal on Austin Cable Access. And I used to show up first to watch, but then to appear on little bits of.
Dashcom, well, nobody needs that YouTube URL.
Too late. Too late. This is amazing. Oh, it's so great. You should be nothing but proud of this, man. It's exactly what year was this?
Oh, God. This is a long time ago. Older than I will officially acknowledge being old.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, wait, Google took
it. I got
it
pulled.
Ah, tell me that didn't get pulled just now. That would be a crime.
I don't know. I'm going to look into this.
dude, that's wonderful. But I'll tell you what, man, Community access television is the land of true genius before it gets corrupted by moneyed interests. How about
This wasn't, this was indifferent. It was some, it was in, it aired in markets. It wasn't community access. It was actually, these smaller little, you know, indie little stations that
was,
were,
was it WPIX?
Oh gosh, I don't even remember. Like it would be like in Palm City in one, or, you know, Stuart, Florida under one, and then somewhere else under like a couple other cities and different ones. And so that was
Andrew, this is so wonderful.
I have no memory of this either. Which
this is the best thing in the world, Andrew. Puffing on a cigarette. Oh, Andrew, this is the best thing ever. I'm so thrilled with it. Right, so my pick is the new Chiller Theater somewhere on YouTube.
Apparently, Elvira made fun of us. Good.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. Wonderful. Wow, I did not expect to have such a revelation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if Justin was here, I'm sure he would recommend something about wrestling.
Yes. Where he's under the weather today and wasn't able to do the show. He has some kind of flu, I think.
He has hells in his cells, I think, is what it is.
Yeah,
hells in his cells.
Hell in the cell flu, and it's the only way he can be cured is by going to hell in a cell.
Oh my gosh, people are finding MySpace pages for this stuff. God bless the internet. Can we before we wrap up talk real quick about the changing emerging shape of permanency on what we say and do? It is fascinating to read wonderful books like Born Standing Up, a collection of memories from Steve Martin, and then before that you have people who worked in the golden age of television, radio. You had vaudeville, especially when you get into the vaudeville days of the early 20th century and late 18th or 19th century. As we learn more about the way memory works, I just am increasingly convinced that everything everybody ever believed is total horse crap, and none of it actually happened the way we remember it. Because, like, that was my favorite moment just now as we were watching this, is when you're like, I have no memory of doing this. And it's like, there's so many moments in my life that are like that, where obviously I put 30, 40, 50 minutes, you know, 2-3 hours of effort into. Hell, there's stuff from hacking the system two years ago where I will watch an episode today and be all like, oh yeah, I guess I did do /say/figure out that. And it's just amazing to me that we now have the permanent record for so many of our lives. And it's already too late for you and me. Maybe that's a good thing. To have all of our lives on record, but our kids, our grandkids are almost certainly going to have the complete archive of their entire life from the moment they're born available.
Because it is weird, because I was just scrolling through this and like I have no memory of these sketches and doing this stuff, right? Now I have one of the people I know is a South Florida entertainer who's in a couple of them. I've ran into him and he has vivid, you know, and we did this, we did that. And I'm like, I believe you, you know, I think I have a very crappy memory. I mean, I have a very, very bad memory. But I'm like, I believe you. But like, I think for him, this was kind of a super exciting thing for him to be doing. Like, I remember working on a David Copperfield production more vividly than I do this. Yeah. I remember, you know, much more kind of vividly that than I do, you know, as a teenager than this. So, it's interesting how we do that. But I think that here's the thing. I say, yes, we're going to have a lot of this sort of, you know, recorded stuff and we'll have that there. But I think that one of the things we're going to start getting into more and more, one of the solutions that comes into Apple touched upon it this week in their keynote where they talk about differential privacy and the way that you can sort of kind of anonymize certain kinds of results or data. If you want to know how many people are using things, there's an example of this would be, this is roughly a description of it. Okay. If you would say you wanted to do a survey and you wanted to find out how many people in a room like had cheated on their wife. Okay. Or had cheated on a spouse. You have 20 people in a room. You give everybody a coin and you tell them, okay, you're going to flip the coin. And if your coin lands on heads, I want you to lie. You know, I want you to, you know, like say the opposite, you know, or whatever. Okay. If it tails, tell the truth. Okay. And so based on that, knowing that.
They gave this example at WWDC?
Not at all. No.
Oh, okay. I was like, that's a bold angle for this.
No. This is an Andrew example of, how you can anonymize data. You know, so if you say flip a coin and 50% of you know that you have to, you know, lie, 50% of you tell the truth, whatever, you can separate that data and you can say, okay, if I take these pools of data, I can now figure out what the actual percentage is because I know statistically speaking, 50% of this is whatever. Okay. Well,
and in the book, A Billion Wicked Thoughts, they talk about a different angle on that. Where it's like you would have, hey, here's a list of 10 things. How many of these apply to you? And, you know, 8 of them are totally safe things and 2 of them are possibly controversial things. And so they would look for where the statistical bump was as they randomized over the long period. And they're like, oh, more than so many of, you know, more than 20% of America has had a sexual encounter before the age of 12, something that they probably wouldn't want to admit on their own, but mixed in, they're all like, well, of all the surveys of all the different 10 question things, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. So it's a growing area as we try to figure out how do you increase levels of privacy? Because part of the problem is you have is you can say, well, I use an anonymous browser, I use Tor and I use that, but you still have a habit. And that is, and if I have systems on servers watching, if I know that at one that every day there's a sequence that you know X number of people go from TechCrunch to these other sites, whatever, is I can create kind of a fingerprint in a sense of somebody. I can create a fingerprint based upon behaviors and stuff. You can still track. You can still figure these things out because only Brian is going to do X, Y, and Z generally in this sort of order.
Right.
So. And that you, but as we start moving through these ideas of privacy and stuff, one of the things I think we're going to get to is this is really, really kind of weird, blue sky stuff. This fear of like, oh, having your sex tape or being like the Hulk Hogan lawsuit and all this sort of stuff. The idea of like, oh, I don't want these things exposed online or these things to get out there, whatever, if you have them. Imagine if you, when you turn on your video recorder, and we're already doing this, or your video camera on your phone, and we're already kind of doing this with Snapchat and Facebook and all this, is we're applying a lot of filters already to you, okay? Next step is going to be we'll create a digital model of you with better skin and better everything like that, and we're going to map that model to you.
Right.
Okay? So we could create, like right now, we could create a 4K version of the show we're doing if we had really good 4K scans of both you and I, and we could sit here and do this sort of keep doing this Skype sort of thing, and then a server could go in and say, I will overlay that 4K scan onto you, capture all, sort of doing what they're doing for movie capture and all that. So what we can do is you can take a low-res version and create a very, very high-res thing using that same actor. But once you have that, you could then say, oh, well, I can have Andrew doing things that Andrew didn't do.
Right.
You know, and then what you're getting into is that we're 5 to 10 years away towards just about any video you see online is actually going to be most video. I mean,
suspect.
A lot of it is going to be totally simulated.
Have you seen the technology where it's like they take famous people and have them saying words that other people don't do? It's astonishing, man.
Yep.
It's amazing where it's like it used to be the gold standard was, well, I got video of you saying it. And then now, given that the fact that memories are so lousy and you're sitting here looking at clips from a show you did 20 years ago and you're like, I don't remember that. Like, there's no motive in this case, but we could enter a world where it's like, oh yeah, no, you did this racist production of Lil Abner back in the day.
Yeah, and I'm like, we saw, you know, in Ant-Man, they did the Michael Douglas rendering was leap years beyond what they did for
Tron.
That was not so good, you know, and that's getting better.
We saw it again in the new Avengers movie, like all of a sudden, and we saw it. They admitted that Pee-wee's not Big Adventure, whatever the new one is.
Oh yeah, Pee-wee's
Vacation.
Big Vacation?
Holiday. Pee-wee's Holiday.
Pee-wee's Holiday, right. That one, they admit, they're like, yeah, no, we nipped and tucked because
Paul had, I've been to parties where Paul talked about that he was going to, you know, that he wanted Pee-wee to stay the same age.
He does not age, right.
Yeah. So, and but that technology we're seeing right now in how we're already using digital filters to improve the quality and how our skin tones look and all that, and that the keep step is going to be to full virtualization. So my point is that, like, yeah, at some point you'll be like, new sex tape released. Yeah, sure. Sure, whatever. I don't believe it. You know, like, it could be, maybe not, that there'll be so much noise out there as far as that stuff is, that a lot of the things we worry about in certain aspects of privacy aren't going to matter as much, because you will have no way to know if it's real or not unless you come out and own up to it.
Well, and wow, fascinating.
Do you think the barrier to entry, just like even if it were computational power were increased, that it's still a much more difficult thing to do to retouch or to create the video evidence compared to making photo evidence?
That's where we are now. Give us 20 minutes and I'll question.
Bryce, what I think is happening is that one is that there's on one hand, there's what the movie industry technology is doing, but there's stuff that, like, there are filters built in right now into your phone, into like the way Facebook processes video, that 10, 15 years ago were high-end broadcast filters they used to smooth out the skin contours of people on, you know, news shows, okay? Or they were using in films, you know, 10 years ago to smooth out, like, actors and things like that to improve that. Now that is becoming real-time stuff. And the next level, not like the next iterative version, but the next big, you know, leap will be when you just say, okay, we will make, you know, the computer will figure out how to make a full 3D reconstruction of what you look like, because also for applications and virtual and stuff, is it's able to say, oh, this is what Andrew looks like. Well, I'll make a 4K version, but I'm going to smooth out your skin tones and get rid of the wrinkles under your eyes and all that. So every time you make a video, that's what goes on to the video. And at that point, when that's automatic, when just about every time you sit down there to do something, because you didn't have to worry about lighting, and we get so used to that being the default, you know, so...
Yeah.
That's where it's heading.
Cool.
Dude.
So I'm saying those sex tapes, they're fake.
I mean, maybe you know, even though I'm deriving a monetary benefit from the use of my likeness for this alleged sex act on this alleged tape.
Well, it only came off once, so it could have been anybody else for the rest of it.
Sure, sure.
Did I just say too much?
Hey, it's been weird.
It's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.